Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dory Smith. Two members of a peace delegation to Gaza speak out about what they found there during a time of very mixed emotions. There was hopeful enthusiasm at the mere fact that 60 of them gained entry to Gaza through the Rafah crossing with Egypt. Leaders of Code Pink and Women for Peace thought they might have to camp out in protest if they were denied access. And then there were feelings of encouragement now that aid has finally been getting into hospitals. Ultimately, though, the harsh reality of the war and its victims has affected them deeply.
What we're hearing from the people is that our presence is the first of what they hope will be a wave of people who will keep getting in and that will eventually force the borders open for them, too.
I don't know. I want to throw myself at the front door of the White House and beg Obama to do something.
We're joined by Code Pink member Pam Rasmussen, who's been blogging about her trip at the website codepinkalert.org. And the co-founder of Code Pink, Gail Murphy, joins us for an update recorded the morning of March 11th. Murphy stayed in Gaza after her fellow peace delegates began their journey home because there were so many untold stories there, she said.
And the soldiers would not let him put his children into the ambulance.
The international press has been granted only very limited access throughout the ground and air war Israel began in late 2008. Sporadic bombing has continued in Gaza, and the ripple effect from the war has been felt throughout the Middle East. Still, the delegates were encouraged by the fact that they at least gained access to Gaza. We reached Pam Rasmussen March 9th.
The reception we've gotten, the hospitality has been amazing. They're just so appreciative that they're getting support from people. They've been very isolated for so long. You know, the siege has been going on for about 18 months. And really very few people have gotten through. And so they feel forgotten, frankly. And they're very appreciative that we're here showing our support and then hoping now that we'll have more and more people coming so the borders will be forced open.
What about the hospital situation and people who may need medical care still?
They finally have gotten enough supplies, basic supplies in that they can care for people. But the infrastructure, you know, a lot of their buildings, including some of the hospitals, have, you know, entire wings that have been bombed. And they can't, there's no building supplies being allowed in, like cement or glass or steel. So they can't rebuild, which, by the way, it would help with unemployment. Unemployment is like 70% here. You know, so if you could put those people to work rebuilding these buildings, it's every government building, public building was bombed. You take care of a lot of problems. Unemployment, the hospitals would have the infrastructure that they need. So they have the basic supplies now. You know, I'm talking about, you know, antiseptics, that kind of thing. Of course, if there's another attack, that they'd be in trouble. We actually have an itinerary tomorrow to visit some hospitals, so we'll find out more tomorrow. I just do know that we've heard that in terms of the medicines, that kind of supply, they finally are at sort of a basic functioning level. But when we've driven by their hospitals, we can see that entire wings have been just gutted. So they're operating in a much smaller part of the building than they usually do.
And we've seen reports of thousands of homes destroyed. What does it look like in Gaza right now?
Well, it really depends on where you are. Now, like right now, I'm talking to you from Gaza City, the largest city in the Gaza Strip. And in Gaza City, you can go into, you know, downtown, et cetera, but you'll find, you know, a stretch of stores that, you know, if you just looked at those stores, you'd think is somewhat normal. But then right next door, you'll see a building that has been completely destroyed. For instance, all the police stations. You know, you get to a police station and it's destroyed. A city council, the parliament. So they are right in the middle of other buildings that are, you know, relatively normal. Now, if you go out into the more rural areas, like by the coastline, then you see just utter devastation. I was up there visiting a women's center in the southern part of the Gaza Strip yesterday, and you have a whole area of 75 homes, including the women's center, that have been completely bombed out, and it looks like a moonscape. This is just a month ago, by the way, that this was destroyed. So it really sort of depends on where you're at. There's damage everywhere, but it's more total if you go out, like, say, by the coastline or, you know, or further out. Go to the city, it's like, you know, be on a block and you'll see one building here and then the next, you know, there's nothing there. You know, it's sort of off and on.
And are there displaced people? And if so, what is their condition? Are they being helped by anyone?
No, I mean, there are displaced people. And thank God for the UN, the relief agency, the UNWRA, because they're really the only agency here that is caring for these forgotten people, really. We went to a refugee camp today, a Jabalia refugee camp, that I was told has 120,000 people in about a square kilometer. I mean, it's apparently the most crowded refugee camp in existence. You know, it's like about half children who are growing up in these conditions. So, yeah, there's a lot of displaced people. They can't rebuild. Like I said, they're not allowed to bring in building supplies yet. So there's no place else to put them except to crowd them into these refugee camps.
Let's talk a little more about the importance of this trip. I know there are some public figures with you, Colonel Anne Wright, and we've interviewed her, and also Medea Benjamin of Code Pink. And then
and Alice Walker.
Talk about Alice Walker. She's made the headlines today in the U.S.
Alice Walker, of course, is a Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist who wrote The Color Purple. And I think it's very important that she is here and using the power of her pen, like she, like, you know, she's been writing statements of her own to speak out. You know, she wrote about the plight of Black Americans in the U.S., and I think everybody would agree if you come here, you see the same kind of discrimination going on for the Palestinians here. So it's very powerful. The other people, I think, that are really treated like rock stars here, probably more than any of us, to be honest, is Cindy and Craig Corey, who are the parents of Rachel Corey, who was a 23-year-old from Olympia, Washington, who came here in 2003 to volunteer and try to stop home demolitions. And she was standing in front of a home trying to stop the bulldozers. No violence, no weapons, but the bulldozers ran her right over and she was killed. The people here revere her, you know, because she put out her life for them. And her parents, who have dedicated their lives since then to furthering Rachel's cause, are treated truly like celebrities here. I mean, I think they're probably the bigger than anybody else we could bring over. And they've just been greeted with an amazing amount of love. And they represent America as well. They help remind the Palestinians that there are other people besides our government who really do understand that the Palestinians are people and need as much attention as the Israelis do.
Talk about your own response to being in Gaza, and I know you marked International Women's Day. What's the significance of this trip to you personally?
I've been to the West Bank three years now, but I've never been able to get into the Gaza Strip. It was always off limits. And so to be able to get in now, you know, we have been able to help a lot. You know, the need is so great here that we are symbolic. What we're hearing from the people is that our presence is the first of what they hope will be a wave of people who will keep getting in and that will eventually force the borders open for them, too. They need to get out, too. So for me, this feeling that perhaps I can do a small amount to help them and to create a better impression of Americans is a really powerful emotional thing. When we visited the Women's Center, you could just tell from the looks in their faces that it meant a lot to them that we were there, just our presence, that we cared enough because they feel forgotten. Gaza is like one of the most forgotten areas in the world, I think, and misunderstood. So to me, it's just, yeah, it's very powerful to feel like I can do something small in a concrete way to help their lives.
And this truly is citizen diplomacy at work. How complex was it to get in? And do you hope in a way that action of the Egyptian government allowing the Code Pink and Women for Peace delegates across the border will open the way for more life-saving aid in perhaps, you know, larger amounts that can make a difference?
It was complex because, you know, we really sort of, I think down deep, thought maybe we wouldn't get in because so many people have been turned away. But I think there are a couple of factors that really came together to help us. You know, one, the UN invitation to come for International Women's Day. The Red Crescent Society was behind us, and they got First Lady Suzanne Mubarak of Egypt behind them, and she endorsed our coming in. And then, of course, the fact that there were several different groups converging at one time, in addition to ourselves, really put pressure on the Egyptians. It took all those factors to get us in, but I think now that we've gotten in, I think it'll be a lot harder for the Egyptians to keep saying no, now that they sort of opened the spigot a bit. I feel very optimistic that we are like the tip of the battering ram, so to speak, and that if we keep pushing, in fact, we just had a meeting today with another peace delegation who's here, and what we're talking about doing is not too long from now, maybe in a month or a month and a half, that we do this again, but we're going to make it even larger and converge on the Egyptians again. And if we keep on doing this and not make it a one-time thing, that they won't be able to keep it closed any longer.
What about the rest of the group, some of them seeing the world, Middle East, for the first time? And I know you have a few young people, lots of women. You brought those pink baskets for the women. And that was, you know, you collected money from the general public for these items. Just talk about the overall impressions you have now of the whole process you set in motion here.
Well, yeah, by the way, there's one young man with us. There's a handful of men. This is his first time outside of the United States, believe it or not. And God, this is his first time. It's amazing. I mean, this was so wonderful about this group. Yes, we have a handful of, you know, celebrity people who have names who are known beyond their neighborhoods, but there's also a bunch of ordinary people here. You know, high school math teacher, for instance. You know, people who have not been very activists before, and because of the invasion and what they heard, they were moved to become activists this first time. And that's what I think is so powerful. And I think everybody in the delegation with me feels like this has been a transformative experience. And we intend to go back home to our various countries and not stop. You know, make sure we go and visit our congresspeople. Make sure we go out and speak at churches and community centers and try to educate other people. And I think you've got a real group of people here who are really feel on fire now and are going to keep this process going.
What would you say to Americans who are unsure about whether or not to support Israel, given that the Obama administration and so many members of Congress do?
I mean, I see this as a human rights issue. You don't have to choose. I think Americans are confused. They think you have to choose between the Israelis and the Palestinians, and you don't. I think they both have needs that we need to pay attention to. But in the case of the Gazans, what I'd want to say to Americans is that, number one, the vast majority of the Palestinians here are just ordinary people. They're not terrorists. They're just trying to live their lives. They're trying to eke out a living and raise their children. They're very family-oriented, value education. And all of that is threatened right now. And what I would ask is that I would say that none of what I see here could be justified for any reason. It's okay to acknowledge the needs of the Israelis and deal with those, but you could do that, but you can't justify what's happened to the people here. You can see with your own eyes that a lot of people have been affected, if not losing family members, but losing, you know, their jobs, their children are traumatized, who are not involved with the military or militants or any of the political parties, actually. Most of the people I've met don't support any of the political parties, you know. And I think that I would just ask them to try to put that aside, to try to put aside the needs of the other and realize that these are humans here just like them. And we have to make sure that they can make a living just like we do. And like I said, nothing really could justify what these people have experienced and are continuing to suffer. The bottom line message I would say is, and the most important thing right now, is the borders have to be opened. They have to be able to move people in and out. They have to be able to move their goods in and out, because if they can't, they can't have business. They can't have jobs. And they'll be dependent on aid forever. And then, you know what? With that kind of frustration building, this will not be a temporary thing. You know, when you lock people in, like a prison, and, you know, close the door and throw away the key, basically, is what happens. People suffer. They get angry. All these young people with no jobs. This can't be just a matter of giving them more food as a humanitarian aid. We have to find a way to let them lead independent, productive lives. And that means opening the borders and letting them live like we do.
Well, in fact, the U.S. envoy to the region, George Mitchell, a former senator, has asked that the borders be open.
Right, absolutely. And now what I think is really important for the U.S. to do is we have to just stop saying it. We have to back it up with action. You know, especially with the new Israeli government in place now, which is much more right-wing than it was before, we can't just say it. We have to back it up. And to me, that means if the borders aren't open, then we have to cut back on our aid to Israel. I mean, it has to be backed up by action. Words will not be enough. I've seen this happen too many times in the past with settlement expansion in the West Bank. Israel keeps doing it, and the U.S. just says it's not helpful. Well, that's not enough, because it keeps on going. Since the Annapolis peace process has started, for instance, the amount of settlement expansion has kept on going. The number of checkpoints have increased. Everything has gotten worse since this peace process has started. And that's because there is no action to back up the words by the U.S. or the EU. So to me, that is the most important thing we have to do. If everybody agrees the borders need to be opened, and you're right, that's what's been said, then we have to be willing to back it up.
We don't know that the Israelis will not bomb again. There's no...
In fact, they still are, by the way. When I was at a women's center yesterday in a sort of rural area near the coast, we heard some sound like thunder, and I asked, and it is bombing. So there is, it's nowhere near like it was, but there is still sporadic bombing and targeting going on now.
The United Nations compound was bombed. I think it was some 40 people died. They were sheltering civilians. And so what happens as a result? I mean, I don't see any move toward holding the Israelis accountable yet.
Well, in fact, we just heard the head of the UN Relief and Works Agency, John Ging, speak today. And that's the thing he stressed, is what's absolutely essential here is accountability on both sides. And what that does mean is an independent investigation into some of those things that happened during the war, including the bombing of the UN Center, because the UN says unequivocally that there were no people shooting from the UN building. So if we do not insist on accountability here, then war crimes will continue to be done and impunity will rule. So that's something that the UN is stressing. In fact, John Ging is coming to Washington, D.C. later this month, I understand. And that's a message that, you know, that he's carrying. There has to be an investigation. Otherwise, none of the world players will have any credibility at all in being fair brokers in the negotiation.
Isn't Israel to be questioned for the attack in general, regardless of whether or not any soldier perceived that there were shots fired, because the UN could just as easily have been under attack from some third-party antagonist? I mean, why would they bomb the UN under any circumstance, you know?
And they shouldn't, not when they know that there are a large number of civilians. They're not supposed to be targeting centers where there's a large number of civilians. You're right, that's against international law.
Well, could it be that Israel is crossing a line here where an increasing number of Americans and other types of peace groups internationally are going to start organizing against the state of Israel's military operations?
I actually personally think that Israel's made a big mistake with this Gaza initiative, because groups like Code Pink, for instance, by the way, Code Pink was not involved in the Palestinian-Israeli issue until the attack on Gaza. And there's a lot of other groups that are the same. The people are now speaking out that never spoke out before. So in the long run, I think this is a huge mistake for Israel, because they have a lot more people who are realizing that it's out of control.
Well, to a certain extent, you know, peace groups have been divided about this question, Israel and the Palestinians, for decades.
But I think the attack on Gaza has really done a lot to unify the peace movement. There were a lot of groups before the attack on Gaza that were ambivalent. This attack on Gaza is pretty universally regarded as way over the line. Disproportionate and not acceptable. And that includes the continuing closure of the borders. Even though they have somewhat of a ceasefire in place, the borders aren't open and there's a growing pressure on that issue. So this has done a lot to unify the peace movement.
The incoming Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said he would improve trade for Palestinians, but that puts him in greater control of who gets to engage in Palestinian trade too, right?
I mean, right now, for instance, any little bit of trade that they do is completely through Israel. They don't have any independence to trade on their own. It's really a captive economy. So even if Israel does develop the economy, it will be to Israel's benefit. The new Prime Minister of Israel has said that he wants to focus not on creating a Palestinian state, but on developing that area economically. But of course, that makes sense for Israel, because it pretty much controls all of the trade that Palestinians can do. For instance, it controls the sources of underground water. A lot of the water in the West Bank and in Gaza goes for the benefit of Israel. And that's the reason why you see a lot of the Palestinian land is very brown, because they have a huge shortage of water themselves. Most of it goes to benefit Israel. So through control of natural resources, the coastline, the airspace, the water, you just keep the Palestinians dependent on Israel. There's some people here we talked to who think, you know, they discovered natural gas off the coast of Gaza.
I see.
And one belief that we've heard here from some of the international volunteers who are here that I don't think has gotten much coverage is that natural gas has been discovered in the waters off the coast of Gaza, which could be a huge source of economic independence for the Gazans. Because, you know, international law says that they should be able to control the 12 miles out from their coastline. However, right now we have this from people who have actually been on the boats, from fishermen. Fishermen who are trying to make a living in the waters are being shot at. If they're even a mile out, you're 1 to 6 miles out. So Israel is still very much in control of the waters, despite the ceasefire and everything else. And there's a lot of people here who believe that maybe that's one of the reasons why the attack happened in the first place, is that they realized that natural gas could be lucrative and want to make sure they can control those resources.
Pam Rasmussen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Longtime peace activist Pam Rasmussen joining us from Gaza March 9th. The website for Code Pink, Women for Peace, is codepinkalert.org. We turn now to the co-founder of the group Code Pink, Gail Murphy, joining us Wednesday, March 11th from Gaza. She has remained there to gather more information about what occurred during the war and its consequences. And she started right out by telling us a story she had just heard.
So I'm standing on a road in Beit Hanun, not far from central Gaza City, and I'm looking into a beautiful orchard, actually, of oranges and olives, and a greenhouse. And above the greenhouse into the sky, I'm looking at a very large blimp-like object floating in the sky, which I've watched all day, that's spying on all of the population along this sort of frontier section that I think the Israelis want to turn into a buffer zone. We're not far from Sderot, Israel, and we just came from a neighborhood called Abu Dhrabo, which was completely demolished. It looks as though an earthquake happened. Some 350 houses were completely destroyed, and we spent the entire afternoon getting stories from the people who return to this rubble every single day, hoping that internationals will arrive so that they can tell their stories, and they are truly heartbreaking. Khalid told us the story of having been in his house. A tank arrived. Soldiers got down, ordered them out of the house. They had already had soldiers come to their house at least four times that year. And so it was not unusual for them to be ordered out of the house or, you know, inspected by the Israeli soldiers. So Khalid came out with his three daughters, and they were standing there being interrogated by these soldiers, not an unusual happening. But what was unusual was that then a sniper shot both his children, his two daughters, all three actually, 7, 4, and 2 years old. The 7-year-old survived and was evacuated to Belgium. He tried to get an ambulance. An ambulance came almost immediately. I'm a little bit emotional because I just heard this story. The ambulance arrived, and the soldiers would not let him put his children into the ambulance, and then ordered the ambulance driver out of the ambulance, told him to take off his uniform, and then they crushed the ambulance. They dragged it under a house, which they then later destroyed when they came through several days later. We just took photos of the ambulance crushed, and it's under a crushed house. These stories are horrible, and these people are living under, you know, a terrible, terrible oppression. They are so afraid that it's going to happen again. They have no reason to believe that they're protected in any way. They have no shelters. They're completely exposed. They have tents that have been set up, and that's it. That's what they have to protect them. Or they've gone back, you know, into Gaza City and are living with in-laws, family members, cousins, whoever they can be with. The families are split up. But they don't want to leave their land. All of them have said, you know, they have nowhere to go. This is their land, and they'll stay even if they die. So I just needed to share that story with you, and I'm sorry if you had other questions you wanted to ask me.
I know Code Pink and Women for Peace also toured hospitals recently. Can you describe more about what you've learned as an organization and how you plan to proceed from here?
Well, what we've learned is that what has happened to the people of Gaza is unconscionable. The massive assault has destroyed so much of the infrastructure. In fact, you know, international organizations contributed to the building of a lot of the public sector buildings, and they're all destroyed. The siege has been going on for 20 months. difficult to get medicines, difficult to get food, difficult for Gazans to go in and out, for Palestinians to come and visit their families. So they cannot get anything to begin reconstruction with. And it's just horrible. They're living in an open-air prison. Where do we go from here? I don't know. I want to throw myself at the front door of the White House and beg Obama to do something. These people are living under a terrible threat. They've lost so many of their loved ones. And there is nothing, nothing that tells them that anyone with the power to stop Israel is going to do that. And so where do we go from here? Is every single door in the Senate and the House to try to get our Congress to understand the war crimes that have occurred in Gaza and to do everything we can to get the American people to realize that we are funding these war crimes, and they are war crimes. We've just heard that the Israeli government has officially said that they see no reason to investigate their military operations in Gaza. And that is so far from the truth. There is white phosphorus that was used on civilians. There is no question that 70% of the people killed, the 1,455, I think, is the number counted now, but people are still dying in the hospitals, and they're still finding bodies under the rubble. So they haven't finished counting the dead from the last assault. And, you know, it's a terrible situation. So we, as Americans, have a responsibility. This assault, in terms of what was rained down on the people so horribly, was made in the USA, a lot of it. And that's against U.S. law. If we don't believe in international law, at least let us abide by U.S. law, which is that we do not permit countries to use weapons we give them on civilian populations. 70% of the people killed were non-combatants. 40% of them were children and women.
I was told earlier by one of your delegates, Pam Rasmussen, that they were getting more supplies in now to the hospitals, but she had yet to see really more of those hospitals. Can you explain what you saw when you were looking into the question of what's available for people with, let's say, more serious injuries or disease?
Well, that I haven't followed that theme, but I do know that food has gotten in, but they have a storage issue. They can't store the food. They don't have enough storage because so many of the facilities have been bombed and destroyed. So the food is exposed. It's not going to be protected. They don't have the capacity to distribute to needy families, but some, you know, several hundred a day in different quarters of Gaza. As far as medicines, you know, I can't speak to that. But tomorrow, in fact, I'm on my way to the Union of Healthcare Workers Committees. They had the only three mobile clinics in Gaza, and they want us to come and document that all three of the mobile clinics were targeted, purposely targeted by Israel, because there's a huge crater in their parking that destroyed all three mobile clinics, and there were no other buildings in that neighborhood that were touched. I was just going to go and find out more about the level of medicine that's available, the severe injuries. I think they're able to evacuate some people in and out, but it's been very, very difficult for people, and the Egyptians are not helping. The fact that we got through the border was amazing, but unfortunately it was to polish the Egyptian image, and it doesn't apply to Palestinians.
What can listeners do now to support the effort to save civilians in Gaza?
They need to brief themselves about the details of the war crimes that are happening and that have happened, and that will probably happen again if we in the United States, as a government, don't speak out strongly and tell Israel to stop. So what they need to do is inform themselves and in turn go directly to their members of Congress, you know, to their state senator, to their senators, and tell them they need to do something, that it is criminal and it is being done in our name with our tax dollars.
Gail Murphy, co-founder of the group Code Pink, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The website, codepinkalert.org. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. This program produced at the studios of WHUS at the University of Connecticut in Storrs, Connecticut. WHUS.org to listen live, Wednesdays at 5 p.m., talknationradio.org for transcripts, audio, and discussions.